Welcome to the Reiki Gateway Podcast with Reiki Masters Kathleen Johnson and Andrea Kennedy. Journey with us and let's explore what lies beyond the Reiki Gateway. Hello and welcome. This is Andrea Kennedy, along with my co-host Kathleen Johnson. We'd like to take a moment to thank you for your support of our new podcast, and it's a wrap. Season one is done. Kathleen and I would like to present you one of our favorite guests that we've had, Nicholas Pearson, as he takes us beyond the Reiki Gateway to talk all about crystals. He is such an expert in his field, and we know that there's always something new to learn anytime we listen to Nicholas. And so we hope that you'll enjoy this replayed episode. And don't worry, Kathleen and I are working very hard behind the scenes to plan an exciting season number two. And we will be back with a brand new episode and a special guest September 29th. So please enjoy our conversation with Nicholas, and we'll see you at the end of September.
Hello, everyone. This is Kathleen Johnson here with my co-host, Andrea Kennedy. Today, we're welcoming a very special guest. Many of you probably already know his name. Nicholas Pearson is here with us. Nicholas is a noted author. He is a Reiki Shihan. He is a teacher. He is many things. And he is incredibly knowledgeable about crystals and Reiki, and we're just delighted to have him here. He's been immersed in the mineral kingdom for more than 20 years. He actually began teaching crystal workshops in high school and later studied mineral science at a university while pursuing a music degree. He also worked for the Gillespie Museum, which is home to the largest mineral collection in the southern United States. He is the author of several books. His most recent one is Crystal Basics, of which I am the proud owner. And I can tell you it's an awesome book, and we'll be talking about it in some more detail. He lives in Orlando, Florida. And Nicholas, I know that's a very short recap of your life. We're looking forward to learning more about you. It is so wonderful to have you here.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much, Kathleen and Andrea, for having me. I'm really excited about today's chat.
I am just thrilled to have you here, Nicholas. I have followed you for quite some time on social media, and of course have some of your books. And I second that, Kathleen. Crystal Basics is so in-depth, so complete. It has theory and science and practice, and it just really leaves no stone unturned. No pun intended, really, but I am really intrigued, Nicholas, because that bit about you teaching crystal workshops in high school, oh my gosh, I just can't even imagine. And what that made me think of is, how old were you when you first learned about crystals? What drew you to them? And then how did that unfold for you? Where did you start with them?
That's a great question. I have been a lover of all things rock related since I was very small. I was that little kid who picked up, you know, pebbles from the seashore or gravel parking lots and driveways or wherever it was. There would be that one stone, or maybe more like that 24 stones, that would talk to me. And I appreciated the fact that it was somewhat ubiquitous, but there were still some that felt special to me in some regards. And it must have been, I don't know, maybe it was a running joke in the family that my pockets were always full of rocks. Maybe it was just my grandfather was very observant, but at the age of 8, he gave me my first mineral specimen, a piece of quartz from Hot Springs, Arkansas. And suddenly stone was transformed from this sort of inert part of the landscape to something more luminous, something more, we'll say regular, concise, geometric. And of course, something mysterious. So I'd seen things like crystals and crystal balls and precious gems and books and cartoons and movies, but now I own one. And it was this magic thing. And I've never looked back. Almost 30 years later, I'm still collecting. I'm still growing the collection. And I'm still learning. So that kind of spurred me to want to dig deeper. When you're 8 years old, there's not a lot you have access to. This was pre-internet days, so I couldn't just hop online and know, read a blog about crystal healing or watch a YouTube video. My dad and I grew up, we didn't do the church thing on weekends. We did the library instead. That was like the cathedral of learning for me. So every couple of weeks I'd go and he'd help me whittle down a stack of books this big and get it to just a handful. And as a child, I believed the library only had to take 4 books at a time, because that's what my father had me convinced of, until we got to the point where he's like, Nicholas, are we really going to read these books in 2 weeks? And 5 days later, we'd be going back to the library to return them so I could get more. But 1 week, it might be science. My dad had a science background with marine science, and I've always had a love for that. But I love, obviously, mineral science and life sciences and all sorts of things. And then the next week, it might be like literature or folklore or mythology. I really loved seeing the sort of correspondence between scientific phenomena, the things we have the right kind of language to describe, and how cultures all around the world talked about the same scientific phenomena through the lens of myth and poetry and metaphor, and often with very similar terms. So early on, I saw the correlation between science and spirituality, and by the time I was in high school, I'd gotten my hands on what few crystal healing books I could find in my local bookstores. I built a relationship with my local metaphysical center, and they just invited me one day. Hey, you could totally teach a class on this. I'm like, yeah, maybe I could. And at the end of my visit, picking out my crystals, the owner, Rita, goes, so what do you think? I think I want these stones. She's like, no, what do you think about the class? I'm like, sure. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And that was 18 years ago. It's half my life. I'm 36 now. So exactly half my life I've been teaching classes. And it started out with just, here's some rocks that I wanted to talk to you about today. Let's talk about ways we can use them. Some of it was very intuitively driven. Some was informed by the literature. And over the years, I've gotten to study with some really amazing and wonderful people in the crystal world, as well as the Reiki world and beyond. So my practice continues to evolve and grow. I was really lucky to study mineral science firsthand. I'm mostly self-taught. I don't have a formal degree in anything, but certainly not in mineral science. But working in the science field allowed me the opportunity to do a lot of, say, deep dive. I was helping to teach geology labs on campus. I was part docent, part preparator for the museum's collection. I got to just be hands-on with rocks day in and day out, and it was my home away from home. When I wanted to get away from school, which was my way to get away from my hometown, I would go to the museum and just spend hours there. I'd spend hours not even being paid as a student volunteer when I was no longer a formal employee. It was just this magical experience, and it's driven me ever since. You can never be bored when you work with crystals.
True. You know what strikes me, Nicholas, in hearing that? I just loved how you spoke about it. What strikes me is the authenticity of that journey, that it started just from within you, this love of the stones. But even as you progressed, and then it wasn't even your idea to teach a class, it was brought up to you. It just is so organic and authentic. It's just, I think, who you are. For me, listening to you talk about it, it just comes through in your words, that genuine frequency, that, I don't know, just a synchronicity about what you do and who you are. It's what you love.
You're so right. I was thinking of the word organic to describe Nicholas's journey. And then when you said it, I thought, yep, that's the word. And authentic. It just felt so real to me. And honestly, that is what comes through in the Crystal Basics book. It's that feeling of, this is an individual who has truly devoted his life to knowledge about the Crystal Kingdom, and of course, Reiki as well, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But it comes through in the writing because it's so well researched and well written and well thought out and so very comprehensive that clearly there's a lot behind that. That doesn't happen with someone who just went to college and got a degree in this or took a couple classes. This is real. It's authentic. It's organic. And it definitely comes through in your book. Wanted to make sure I mentioned that part of it because it's so true. Now, Nicholas, I'd like to know, as a fan of that book, how that book came to be. Can you share the backstory of it and what prompted you to write that book? It was just interesting to me because you had several books published before Crystal Basics, and this is your most recent one. I know you have a few more in the works, but why Crystal Basics at that time, and how did that come to pass?
Truth be told, I had no interest in writing a beginner-level book at any point, because it's been done so many times, and there's so many accessible, wonderful books out there, written by friends and colleagues and teachers of mine. So initially, it just wasn't something in the cards, so to speak. My very first book, The Seven Archetypal Stones, is a deep and esoteric dive, and it's kind of out there, we'll say, and I enjoyed the challenge that it posed for me, and then I kind of rolled with the punches and put out a few more things, but then it was actually working in the field. I work for a local metaphysical store, an occult bookstore, currently one of the managers of the space, but while I was just there a couple days a week to accommodate my teaching and writing and traveling schedule, it was responding to people's questions on a weekly basis, listening to the kinds of concerns people had, hearing what needs weren't being met by the literature on the market. That's what made me start to assess what should a complete manual look like, at least the Nicholas Pearson take on the complete manual. So I started to collect people's questions and ideas and do some critical thinking about it, and then collate that and see, like, where in my teaching do I have gaps? Where in my writing do I have gaps? How can I make an all-in-one resource? I really wanted it to be all in one. So it's everything from the theory and the science of it, which I adore, but I know it's not everyone's cup of tea. And then you get the dictionary of 200 stones there. So it's got a good directory of crystals. I can see the body, mind, and spirit all rolled into one. But I wanted to teach people how to think critically. And that's always been my goal in my writing and my teaching. Mm-hmm. I've always viewed writing as an extension of my teaching practice. I love to share. I love to inspire. So the goal with Crystal Basics was to, even if it is a lot for someone to digest, it's paced out in a way that you can just use it as a reference tool if you want to look up a particular crystal. If you want the hands-on part, you can just look at that section. If you want to go into the depth of the science and spirit of how and why crystals do what they do, that's there too. So I just wanted, like, how do I think about crystals and how can I teach other people to think about them to arrive in one book?
You certainly succeeded. I use it primarily as a reference. I keep it in my family room, so it's easily accessible to me. I'm really happy that you wrote that book, and I look forward to seeing the ones that are coming up, because I'm sure they'll be just as good. Now, I'm interested as to how you view the intersection of metaphysics with the science of minerals. I mean, that is always a big, I don't want to say controversy, but in a way it is. Established science still doesn't really recognize crystals as being anything but pretty things to look at. And I would just like to get your take on the intersection of the mineral kingdom with metaphysics.
You know, science definitely recognizes that there are a lot of crystalline materials, making not all rocks and gems per se, that exhibit some pretty extraordinary properties, whether that's optically or mechanically or electrically or electromagnetically. Crystals do things that other systems do not, and it all hinges upon this idea of coherency. And that's a science word just to describe order. The level of order that you find in a crystal is the reason we have crystals. Without order, there is no crystal in anything. Without order and organization and regularity, we don't get these beautiful gemstones. But we also don't have a lot of technology. Crystals are responsible for a lot of things we use in our communications technology, in our handheld devices, and it's not necessarily quartz, it's other substances, although quartz has historically played a really important role in a number of devices, the old crystal radio sets in World War II, the U.S. government and other foreign governments actually hoarded optical-grade quartz as a strategic move so it couldn't fall into enemy hands, so to speak, because the higher the quality of the crystal, the farther the signal can go and the better reception. Those are important things. So that crystals have gifts to share with us is a noted fact. And my stance has always been to look at what we can, let's say, measure or at least map out in terms of the physics of crystals as a means of understanding the metaphysics of crystals. I can't objectively measure subtle energy. That's the reason it's subtle.
Right.
It is immeasurable. Science certainly leaves a little bit of leeway for these things we can't quite understand just yet. So my route has always been, well, what can we measure? What is the model that we can use? And if I look at the physics of crystal energy, if I look at their coherent forms, which generate coherent energy fields, which in turn changes, or maybe we'll say entrains our own electromagnetic fields to be touch more coherence. We know from a number of peer-reviewed studies that shifts in coherency, especially heart-brain coherency in the human electromagnetic field, change mood and perception. There's a measurable and demonstrable response in electrical and chemical transmitters that cascade all throughout the entire organism when we have this more coherent state of being. And as a result, we can go from that electromagnetic state to superseding our pathology. This has been measured time and time again, and usually it requires very sensitive equipment like the SQID, the superconducting quantum interference device that they use to measure all sorts of fun stuff, but especially it's a big one in energy medicine research. So it stands to reason that if crystals are already so coherent, and when two electromagnetic fields, let's say, interact, the one that is more coherent will have a, what we call a higher amplitude, or we'll say a louder signal, and it entrains the other one to sync up with it. And so they get on the same station on the radio. And that is something that we know electromagnetic fields do. I'm an electromagnetic oscillator. Garnet I'm holding is an electromagnetic oscillator, but it's more ordered, more coherent than I am. So it stands to reason it ought to teach me to be more coherent as our electromagnetic fields interact.
All right.
And that's the primary model I use, at least for the physics of crystal healing. Now, here's the great thing. We've never measured this. There is no peer-reviewed journal that says, absolutely, this is the one and only way it works. But I think it is a valid pathway for how crystals can heal. But there's still all the stuff we can't measure. There's still that unknown. There's still that idea of consciousness. Mm-hmm. At heart, I'm an animist. I like to believe that all things around us have consciousness. And so there's some conscious interaction taking place with the spirit, the essence, the key, we might say, of that stone or any stone. And there's something that I'm just fine with not being able to measure. So I like the science, but at the end of the day, there's a great mystery we've got to surrender to. And that's the name of the game here. We don't have authentic spiritual experience without the surrender to mystery. And that's where I come back to time and time again.
That's an interesting perspective. And honestly, I share that perspective when I talk about Reiki, because people will say, how does it work? And I say, we don't really know. I just know that it does work. And I can explain a little bit about the science of crystals, not quite as eloquently as you just did, but I have a basic understanding of the physics and the structure and all that. But I'm completely with you, Nicholas. There are some things I truly believe that are simply not meant to be explained. And I'm okay with that. I think it makes life far more interesting than having explanations slapped on everything. So I was really happy to hear you say that. And I am curious. I know you teach crystal classes. How much do you delve into the science of it when you teach a crystal class?
A fair amount, honestly. Whether I'm in the retail setting, helping someone pick out a rock, or I'm in the classroom setting teaching about crystal healing, my goal is always to start with science. What can we measure? What can we identify? This crystal is a calcium carbonate. This stone is rich in iron. This has a hexagonal crystal structure. Sometimes that one sentence is as much science as someone can handle, and the eyes glaze over, and then you move on to what they really came to you for. But I like to start with the science of what is a crystal. How do we define it? What does the term actually mean? Because it has a very narrow description.
Yeah.
Therefore, Absolutely. What is a mineral, a rock, a gemstone? These are all terms that we might use interchangeably, but they have very specific connotations. So if we start there, it gives us an idea for understanding the rest of it. And while I don't like to dwell too much on just science, I like science to be the platform for understanding the how and the why of everything else. There is a different personality to a mineral, which is a single crystalline substance, versus a rock, which is an aggregate of multiple crystalline and sometimes even non-crystalline substances. So if we know what the fundamental difference between a rock and a mineral is, then when we pick up a garnet versus a piece of marble, we can be prepared for what our subjective experience is going to be and how that might differ without necessarily setting someone up or planting a seed and shaping that personal experience too much.
That makes sense. Now, you said you teach in a retail setting. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I work in my local metaphysical shop. It's first been there almost 3 decades, and I've been on the team for several years now, and I help with the primary buying for rocks, but then I also work on the sales floor, and it's a great experience. I get to sign books every day and help people find rocks, and sometimes the experience lasts 30 seconds. That's all the time you have in a high-paced retail environment, and other times it's a little bit more leisurely. It keeps me from being too much of a hermit in my writer mode.
You are a prolific writer. There is no question about that. Now, I'm also curious as to how the past year, the pandemic, has altered your life in terms of traveling and teaching. How are you managing with all that? How have you had to shift your life, your business, your practice?
I've gone online with teaching my crystal classes. I prefer to teach Reiki in person, so I've suspended that. And in lieu of teaching, I do a virtual Reiki share every month, which still allows me to share space with people in that Reiki setting. And that's been really wonderful because the group grows a little bit each month and I get to connect with new people and familiar faces, and they don't have to be local to me anymore, which is wonderful. It's also the good thing about online stuff in general. I can also reach a category of people who might not be able to attend live if I can send out recordings for classes. So that's been great because I feel so much support and love and excitement around crystals. They continue to increase in popularity. And if I can get some, say, good quality information out there, because let's face it, the internet is full of stuff that is questionable at best and suspect at worst, we'll say. And it's nice to offset that just one 2-hour class at a time. So that's something that I've really enjoyed. And there's much less overhead. I can teach out of my own home instead of boarding a plane and packing my rocks and carrying rocks sometimes around the world. Rocks are heavy.
Right,
and if I only have to carry them from one shelf to the next to teach online, that is wonderful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it sounds a whole lot easier, definitely. And isn't it wonderful that we are engaged in these types of endeavors and practices that allowed us so easily to shift from in-person to distant? I am grateful for that. And I am sure you are too. Perhaps you can share with our audience a little bit about your classes and how often you have them and how they might be able to find you.
Sure. So I have a new series that I started this year that I'm calling my Monolith series. It's a little bit of a pun. I know that at best, and I love the word. The monolith means single stone, but usually we think of monolith as being like a big pillar or a monument or even a building right out of the rock face. The idea behind the series is we pick one stone and we do a deep dive and view how that one stone can support us. That one stone can have a whole range of practices. So we look at the science of it, the history of it, the mythology of it, the modern metaphysical lore about it, and we find those common threads to trace a big picture, and then we engage with practices just with that one stone. So far, I've only taught two, and we started earlier this year, but I've got a plan for a good number of them going forward. And I've got information about those on social media currently, and eventually I'll get my website overhauled, so it'll all be there. I'm going to do a monthly Reiki share. And then I have a few stores that, since I'm not visiting physically, since I'm not traveling anywhere, they've been gracious enough to host me for online classes. That was a big thing I did last year, never having taught online before. Making that transition to do virtual tours and do some more of that later this year. I've got a few on the calendar already, and I'm going to work with a few more spots. So stay tuned. I'll have all those details available. When
I love the idea of the monolith. That's really innovative. That would be really interesting to truly engage with one stone and see where it takes you. It's a great idea. It made me think of another question, and that is, do you have a favorite crystal?
It's like asking a parent their favorite child. I'm sure the answer is yes, but they don't like to say it in public. Absolutely. I've got a handful of favorites, we'll say. There are thousands upon thousands of different mineral species, and then they come together to form countless rocks and variations. So sometimes there are like those perennial favorites that stay with me, and then other times you find something new and exciting that just really you're in the moment with. Anything in the quartz family that has a very special place in my heart, because that's what catapulted my journey forward. The others that I always tend to say are rhodonite. Rhodonite has been such an important ally for my own personal healing journey. And then petersite. Petersite is the first gemstone someone put in my hand, and I just lost my mind over it. Like I could get lost in the stone. It's enigmatic. It's beautiful. And you have a high quality piece. The chatoyance, the color, the movement of light through it. It's just so enchanting. So I really love petersite. I love what it represents. It's called the tempest stone, and it helps us through those tempestuous, tumultuous times in life by becoming the eye of the storm. You know, here I'm in Florida. We're very familiar with hurricanes. So the eye is where there's calm amidst the chaos of life. And petersite enables us to cultivate that inner calm in spite of outer chaos. And it does so much more, but it's a very empowering kind of stone. And it can feel chaotic because as the storm approaches, you've got to go through all that chaos to get to the stillness in the middle. And it can be a really powerful ally for any period of transition or transformation.
Oh, that's really amazing.
That's fascinating. Yes, I know that when you work with crystals, you sometimes it's hard to sometimes choose just one favorite because, well, they're all wonderful in their own way. But I, too, have my own favorites. I just don't like to say it out loud because I don't want to hurt any of the others' feelings, right? I do appreciate sharing your knowledge with us. And for the people who are kind of just new to crystals or starting on their crystal journey or really want to start diving in and learning more, is there any piece of advice or any suggestions or recommendations you can offer to maybe smooth that journey and help them along?
For sure. One, it's overwhelming. If you go to a really well-stocked metaphysical store, you might have hundreds of options. So pick a handful. They don't have to be the most expensive, especially when you're just getting started. And if it's in your budget, then go for it. I love a really nice and zinc quality mineral specimen myself. But I get that's not always friendly on the budget. And you can work some pretty profound magic with some tumbled stones if you spend the time cultivating a relationship with them. So pick a handful and get to know them. Like, really get to know them. Don't just read a post on social media that correlates certain stones to your chakras and call it a day. Spend time with them. Meditate with them. Feel them when you're happy. Feel them when you're sad. Feel them when you're indifferent to the world. Feel them when you are excited. And see what is the same each time and also what is different, because crystals are master reflectors. Part of what they reveal to us is a reflection of what's going on already in us. So sometimes we experience something that we attribute to the crystal, but it is really us and the crystal is just revealing it. So I think it's important not to just judge everything based on that initial time. Oh, I held this crystal and it immediately filled me with joy. Okay, maybe it did. Maybe there was a seed of joy inside you that just revealed that to you. Maybe there's some other mechanism going on. A lot of crystal literature is very prescriptive. Carry X crystal for Y condition, and life gets better, right? And then real people go out and they try that, and they have X condition in their life, so they want Y crystal. And when they marry the two together, they don't get the same results, because we're only looking at the superficial results and not the process beneath it. So spending time getting to know your crystals will help to reveal what their inner voice is, what the deeper mechanisms are that are at play. Certainly, I want people to go out and buy crystal books, not just mine. There are lots of great ones on the market. But you know, when we read them, read critically. Think about the why behind things. There are a lot of crystal books that are based on intuitive information and intuitive information alone. And that means that when it's been published, maybe it's never been tested in the field. So This stone revealed this to one person, one particular example of one particular stone. We're all fundamentally human beings, the same genus and species and subspecies. We have the same number of chromosomes for the most part, and we're pretty darn different, though. We are on the most fundamental level, different personalities, and the same is going to be true of rocks. So if you get one piece of quartz, it's going to be different than the piece of quartz someone wrote about in a book or spoke about on a podcast or blogged about online. So you know, be prepared for a little bit of variation there. And if you hold space for that, nature is perfectly imperfect rather than imperfectly perfect. When we hold space for that mystery, when we allow variation in spite of the rigid laws that define crystallinity, there's still little variances there. And when we allow that to take place, when we allow ourselves to experience that open-heartedly, then we also find the same space within us that is perfectly imperfect. So I think there's a magic in just spending time with your stones rather than only reading about them in books. But for sure, yeah, read about them in books. Buy my books.
That's excellent advice. That really is. And honestly, I wish I had someone tell me that early on when I started my crystal journey. It would have been helpful to know that as I was starting out. And what you said is so true. I've sat with stones and meditated with stones over the years that I receive a different energy from, get different messages from, than what's written in the books. And initially, I was confused and I thought I was doing something wrong. No, it's just that particular stone had a message for me or an energy for me, and that's the way it wanted to work with me. So once I started to accept that and embrace that, it made things a lot easier. So I really appreciate you sharing that with our audience, because I think that's important to know, especially for people just starting out and you just don't want to run to a crystal store, get a whole bunch of stones and think they're going to change your life in miraculous ways, you know, without doing some of the work, right?
Yeah, it's like buying equipment for your home gym. Like, just because you own a set of weights doesn't mean you have big muscles. Like, you have to use them, you have to apply them. Crystals are not a substitute for the work. It's not a magic pill that you take and your life right. is better instantly. It still takes work. What crystals are catalysts. A catalyst is defined as something that lowers the amount of energy or effort required to produce a particular outcome. In our body, we have enzymes that catalyze reactions for every little process at the cellular level and above. We have enzymes that hasten the breakdown of our food so we can derive nutrients from that. Well, in a spiritual sense, crystals catalyze the process of healing and growth, the psychological, spiritual, mental levels. Of course, that I believe that translates to our physical body. But the deal is that you can't just put some rose quartz in your pocket and instantly find the love of your life. First off, that's not rose quartz's mission. It's not here to make you succeed romantically. It may be the end result if you do the work, but that's not what rose quartz can help you. Rose quartz is here to help us bring a sense of fluidity back to stagnant emotions. One of its primary mechanisms is allowing things that are stuck and frozen in place to flow freely again. That can ultimately make space for love in our lives. It can facilitate the process of forgiveness and help us move on from the past. It can even help us invite in a romantic future. But rose quartz is not just the love stone as people peg it to be. I think that is a viable byproduct, but it's not the mission. And that's another thing that we tend to do when we look at crystals prescriptively. We have things like rose quartz becoming the love stone, or we associate lapis lazuli with being a throat chakra stone just because it's blue. And there's so many things we could tackle about that paradigm, but suffice it to say that its purpose for being here is so much more enriching than just helping you speak. And we've got to start to think critically, like, where did we arrive at these ideas about crystals? How reductive are we being? And I think that's not a bad thing. Getting straight to the point, having a bottom line is important at the beginning level. So we can have faith in this. We don't feel overwhelmed by it. But then start to question everything. It's amazing when we start to really think critically and connect the dots and build our own relationship. And then you have your own language of symbolism that goes along with the steps.
It's so true. And I think that's something to remember, not just for crystals, but in anything we undertake in life. We have to do our work. We can collect tools in our toolbox and knowledge, etc. But at the end of the day, we are with ourselves and we need to do our own work. The thing that comes to mind with me there is Reiki. You're a Reiki master, Reiki Shihan, as am I, and as is Andrea. And I'm sure you've encountered people who expect Reiki to be the panacea that solves all their problems. But at the end of the day, no, we still have to do our own heavy lifting. And I think that's really important to remember.
Absolutely.
What you had just said about this idea of rose quartz not being the love stone and how people are very superficial sometimes with looking for those solutions, that really resonated with me, and it made me think of medicine, how people have an ailment and they want to pop the pill and have it be behind them. And so I can see this so really very common through culture to do that. And I think we're all into sound bites and quick fixes and things like that. I find your conversation about that very refreshing and very grounding. Really about spending time, not rushing, building the relationships. I really thought that was such really profound advice. I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. That's the mission here, getting people to build that personal experience.
Yes. And another question that I had for you was about Reiki. We talked about how you were very young when you got interested in crystals and how that sort of grew from that internal, authentic place, that organic place for you. And so when did you first hear about Reiki? And can you just tell us a little bit about that and how you progressed?
Yeah, so my journey with Reiki began as a late teen. I came across the term here, there, and elsewhere, but I didn't really know any people who practiced firsthand, and if I did, they weren't vocal about it. I was so immersed in my school life that trying to add too much to the outside of that was certainly not going to happen. But I came across it in reading. I found, I think, Diane Stein's book in the local library, and that was my first introduction to Reiki, and I passed it over. There was something about it that just didn't do it for me. And over the years, I eventually met some people who practice, and I got to experience being on the receiving end of it. And I made the decision to start studying Reiki because at the time I had a really challenging time with my mental health. I've been in school for a couple years at the university level. That is a time in a young person's life when you are just overwhelmed by change and transition and new responsibilities, and you feel even the most well-prepared person academically is not prepared for what the rest of life has to offer and how you suddenly have to do all this stuff for yourself. So the shift in all that dynamic was a challenge for me, and I've always been really open about having an anxiety and panic disorder, and I took the allopathic route. I was visiting the counseling center. I was using medication to help manage that, and I never found the right fit. There's not, in that exploratory phase of my mental health, I didn't find the right practitioner, the right medicine, and it was not a great time in my life, if I'm being honest. However, one of the direct results of that was exploring a lot of integrative routes. So I first explored flower essences around that time. Of course, I was practicing my regular meditation practice. I was using gemstones, but then came Reiki, and suddenly it wasn't this external tool, it wasn't a pill, it wasn't a human being who had to listen to me talk about my life and come up with an action plan based on that, it wasn't a rock, it was nothing outside of me. The power was right here in the palms of my hand, and the power of my breath in my own heart. So Reiki changed my life, Reiki saved my life. I went from, on a bad day, having more anxiety attacks than should be humanly possible. We'll just put it that way. We won't quantify, but it was not
okay.
Pretty. To most years, having fewer than I can count on one hand.
Oh.
Yeah, last year has been extraordinary. Life happens
mm-hmm.
where
yes.
things take place, and you just roll with the punches. So not every year has a perfect track record, we'll say, but Reiki was this amazing balm for me. And I took my first degree training in May of 2006 with my very first teacher, Patricia. She had studied, among other people, with William Lee Rand, the International Center for Reiki Training. This was just before she became a licensed teacher through the ICRT. She would, not too long thereafter, also bring Hiroshi Doi to her center in Vero Beach to teach there. And I was a poor college kid and I couldn't afford it. And back then the class was like $500 and I just couldn't swing it. And you can't train with Doi Sensei for $500 today. So that'll
mm-hmm.
go on my big list of Reiki regrets. But Patricia,
oh.
yeah, Patricia was half Japanese. And she really, even though the flavor of Reiki that she taught was decidedly Western, it was with so much respect and so much reference to the sort of cultural context out of which Reiki was born. She was very passionate about teaching Reiki precepts, not only just learning what they meant on a personal level, but being able to recite them in Japanese. That was like, oh, I want to take this farther. I want to learn how to write them in Japanese. I want to learn how to decode them myself. And so I began teaching myself the Japanese language just for this one project, which helped me later in life. But Reiki is this amazing experience. And since that year, 2006, I took first and second degree. A few months later, I took a few years of just practicing for myself before going into the third degree. In 2009, I went to Japan on a really magical experience. I received a Reiki master initiation in Reicho, Tokyo, inside a Buddhist temple at an international Reiki gathering. They did this monthly Reiki share, and this was totally Usui Shiki Ryoho, very Western Reiki, in Japan. And later, I would study things like Komyo Reiki with Hyakuten Inamoto, Jikiden Reiki with more than one teacher, but including Frank Argento Petter. So I studied very, very Japanese Reiki here in the North America, and then super Western Reiki in Japan. So I just like to do things backwards sometimes, but Reiki has been this incredible experience for me. And I am so passionate about it because once you learn it, you've got it. After that that first degree initiation, attunement, ignition, placement, transformation, empowerment, whatever language we're using to describe that experience, we all have the same hands. As a Reiki teacher, there is nothing unique about my hands versus yours, except maybe I've been doing it longer. That's about it. And I firmly believe we are all one in Reiki. As Hyakuten Sensei, the founder of Komi Reikido, Reiki is above all human division. Reiki is above the world of the pair of opposites. Reiki is non-duality. Reiki is oneness. We can't have more Reiki or less Reiki. We can't have more powerful or less powerful or higher octave or new vibration. We might have other things around that. But in Reiki, we are all one. And Reiki is already permeating the whole universe. And that fundamental experience of an initiation allows us to become aware of it, become conscious of it, and better learn to surrender to it. And just that act of surrender was all I really needed for my mental health to kind of find a new chapter. A big, big thing for me is uncertainty. When uncertainty takes over, then the wheels go and I get on the anxiety train and it is like careening off the cliff. But if I recognize that we can't know and I'm going to surrender, then it just puts the brakes on the train. Just that simple.
That's just beautiful, Nicholas. Absolutely beautiful. And I couldn't agree more. Reiki to me is like a universal language. It's a universal commonality. And so when you spoke about that, it just so resonated with me. And I do have a question. When you offer Reiki sessions, do you combine crystals with your Reiki sessions, or do you keep those modalities separate?
Generally speaking, I don't tend to combine my crystals and my Reiki unless someone is requesting it. Certainly the person on the table gets their needs met. That is the most fundamental experience to anyone who's in the healing arts, I think. But crystal healing is a complete modality unto its own. Reiki is a complete modality unto its own. And I think the tendency in especially Western branches of Reiki that are a little bit farther removed from like the core spirit, the core fundamental values of the teaching. When the shift began to happen after the transmigration period, when Reiki was brought beyond Japan, we had essentially a sole progenitor for all branches of Reiki. And then as it began to branch off and a little bit of the soul and structure of the practice might have gotten disconnected for some practitioners, they tried to make up for it. And they did so in very creative ways. They might have added things to the system. They might have substituted things that they didn't understand. And it can make some Reiki practices a little bit cluttered. When I first learned Reiki, we had crystal grids involved. We talked about ways to use crystals in our practice. And I love crystals. So I loved those things. But I have found that the less I do in Reiki, the more powerful the end result. So I tend to treat those two things as separate practices. And you don't turn Reiki on and off. If you really are a practitioner, if you're really dedicated, it's just there. And it's in everything anyway. So I can't definitively say that I never mix and match, because if I'm building a crystal grid, if I'm laying stones on a versa, Reiki is flowing. Absolutely. Without a doubt, it is there. But if someone comes to me for a Reiki session and that's all they ask for, that's pretty much all they get. Because I think there is a very powerful act in the simplicity of showing up for someone. And to do so wholeheartedly, with the entirety of your intention, and to just be present and hold space. That is a really powerfully intimate thing that we don't get a lot of today. So as much fun as I have piling rocks on top of people, I allow them to be the leader in whether or not I'm going to mix and match. And I think the two work harmoniously together, and there's nothing wrong whatsoever with mixing and matching. It's just not the thing I'm primarily called to do.
It just so impresses me how clear you are about who you are and how you approach the different interests, the different areas of very deep education that you have. I just keep thinking of the word impressive. I don't mean to embarrass you, but you're very impressive to me, Nicholas. And I did want to mention that the book that you wrote, Foundations of Reiki Ryoho, a manual for Shoden and Okuden. And it is such a complete book. And you mentioned Diane Stein's book from many years ago. And I remember that was one of the first books. And way back then, when I first started, there were hardly any books at all. And I notice when new books come out about Reiki, because in recent years, we've really done more research and learned more and more. And it is very fascinating. But your book, oh my goodness, it's jammed with information for people. It is comprehensive. It's the deep dive. It strikes me, Nicholas, that you're just not a shallow diver in anything that you do. You very much give it your all, and you're very committed and respectful of everything that you seem to engage with. And I just wanted to point that out as what I've observed with you and your work.
Thank you. Yeah, that book was a very special labor of love for me. And even just a few years post-publication, if I could go back and rewrite sections of Foundations of Reiki Ryoho, I might, because we learn as time goes on. New information comes up, and the academics that are devoting their lives to the study of Reiki from different facets. We've got people who are medical and integrative specialists who are researching the efficacy of Reiki in a clinical setting. We've got people who are historians, people who are, they've got their master's in library sciences and religious studies specializing in Asian religions. We've got people who are ethnographers and so many other brilliant academics. They're a small group, but they're really well-rounded. So they dig things up, and there are things I would change. There are things that I believed to be wholeheartedly true when I wrote that book that maybe there's a little bit of doubt on, and I would frame things a little bit differently. So it continues to be a passion project to learn about Reiki, and having a complete and accurate picture of Reiki history doesn't innately make you a better practitioner. So just because I'm a history nerd doesn't make me a better Reiki person, not by a long shot. The only thing that makes us a better practitioner is practice. So my goal in writing that book was to inspire people to do just that, which is why there's the hands-on stuff, which is why it's laid out as a classroom manual. The book actually began as a stack of notes I gave students. I was using other manuals to teach my classes, and they didn't do things in the same sequence as me. They didn't approach all the same topics that I did. They didn't give the same depth to the things that I found most inspiring in my personal practice I wanted to share with my students. So I would supplement that, and then the stack got bigger and bigger and bigger. So eventually I just thought, why don't I write a book, and maybe someone will publish it. And it turns out that's what happened.
Wow, that's really amazing. And this reminds me of the beginning of our conversation when we were, well, towards the beginning, when we were talking about metaphysical properties of crystals and how there's mystery still. And so we continue to seek, we continue to ask these questions. And that's no different in Reiki. And even in the book that you wrote, it's always, we're always asking more questions and digging deeper, like you say. I think that goes such a long way for us to even stay engaged and interested in these topics.
Oh yeah, and it's right there in the name of the third degree too, Shinpida, the mystery teachings. We have to engage with the mystery. We have to hold space in our heart for the unknown. We have to be willing to steep our entire being in the stillness and yet the dynamic movement that is Reiki. And it's that kind of cognitive dissonance we get to, that's magic. I invite people who are longtime Reiki practitioners who've taken, you know, the training the one time they did it and made their whole life about Reiki to do something a little bit different. Devote themselves to the most fundamental practice. Do one thing and do it with your whole heart instead of going through the motions, because we all do it. I go through the motions. I like to practice the Joshin Kokyuho meditation. It's a beautiful meditation that cleanses body, mind, and spirit with the breath. And some days, I'm just breathing. I'll be honest. Human being, the laundry list of things is playing in my mind, and I'm just breathing. There's a visualization attached to that, but it's just breath. And there are other times where it's not just breathing. I am not breathing Reiki. Reiki is breathing me. And it's only because I'm willing to try and fail and try again that it happens. And it's the same with our hands-on practice. The simplicity of just placing my hands and being present seems like it shouldn't do anything whatsoever. Medical people agree with us. It should do nothing whatsoever. But the science tells us that it does. We don't fundamentally know without a doubt why. And that's okay. I would love to know why, but I'm also a little bit tickled. The science-y people in medicine, the researchers, they can look at the data and say, okay, this is doing something, and we have no idea why, but maybe we should get it into more hospitals. Or you know, cells and animals, they don't fall victim to the placebo effect. So how this can influence us when we can't measure it, and yet the effect is there on isolated cells and tissues. that are not part of a living, breathing thing with a personality and an ego to be influenced. It still works. So maybe we should keep trying to figure out why. And they're still trying. Yet here we are as practitioners just doing it. We know it works. We've seen it. So there's so much joy that comes from revisiting the basics time and time again and giving yourself over to them. If you're going to chant the precepts, chant the precepts. If you're going to do the Giho, the Japanese Reiki techniques, really do them. If you're going to do hands-on practice, just do hands-on practice. And it's incredible the profundity that those things can bring.
So well said. Absolutely beautiful, Nicholas.
Nicholas, it's been great having you here today. I really appreciate you sharing your time with us. It was very generous of you, not to mention your knowledge and your experience. And for our listeners, I want to make you aware of several projects that Nicholas has in the works right now. He is currently hosting an online Reiki share. That link will be in the show notes at the bottom of our podcast. And also, he's in the process of writing not one, not two, but three new books. I know I'm pretty excited about that. Two of them, I understand, are Reiki-related, and one is a little bit different. It's about flower essences. Honestly, I don't know where you find the time to do everything you do. I asked Andrea before we started, I wonder if he sleeps. Seriously, you are a busy, busy guy.
Yeah, I don't sleep a lot. That's been a lifelong challenge of mine. I go for quality, not quantity, when it comes to sleep. Ever since I was a little kid, I stayed up late at night reading books, sometimes books about rocks. Yeah, I do have some exciting new releases coming out. I can finally share. I just signed a contract for book number 8, which will be a crystal encyclopedia. It's my first time discussing that on air, so I don't have a formal release date. The book is only about half done. That'll be coming out hopefully next year, but for sure next spring or summer. I have my flower essence book called Flowers from the Witch's Garden, Plant Spirits in Magical Herbalism, and that's going to be super fun. I love flower essences. It's another form of vibrational medicine. It's just an incredibly easy way to work with the blessings of nature, and there really was no guide that described these sort of, say, extended techniques for working with essences. I have training in a variety of unusual modalities beyond just Reiki and crystals. And one of my biggest influences has been Christopher Penzack, co-founder of the Temple of Witchcraft, author of many books. But he teaches a bunch of classes on working with plant spirits as allies and also on flower essences, particularly the ones that come from baneful or poisonous herbs. And the mechanisms that they bring to the table are so different than some of our other plant allies. And flower essences are great because they are not a chemical derivative of the plant. They're totally vibrational in nature, so they're safe. They don't interact with anything else except on that spiritual level. And they were a lifesaver for me. They're the bridge between the allopathic world and then surviving my anxiety until I made it to Reiki. And they've been powerful allies for me ever since. So we start editing that book later this year, so it can come out for either a spring or summer release of next year. And I do have a couple other Reiki projects that are very slowly, let's say, germinating right now. I've got the long-anticipated sequel to Foundations of Reiki Ryoho that will eventually come out. Since it's a first and second degree manual, I do have a third degree manual planned. Very little of it is written. I was hoping some of the brilliant academics working in the Reiki field would publish some of the research they've done on a wider scale so I can cite them and give them credit for amazing things they're doing, which will shape some of what comes up in that book. But we'll just see. I'm taking it one day at a time when it comes to that. And my other Reiki project, it's too soon to give much away, but it's like a collection of essays that take us deeper into the heart of the system and look at things from a lens that approaches that keyword authenticity. Where does Reiki really come from? And if we understand where it's coming from, then we can also understand where it's taking us. And that's why I'm passionate about Reiki history, just as an aside. If we know where it's been, we can map the trajectory of where it's going. And that's not about whose system is better or more accurate. It's just looking at how we got to where we are, and that's going to help us plan for the future and plan brilliant things together. Reiki is approaching 100 years. The Usui system of Reiki is approaching 100 years. And what an exciting time to be alive and be participating in Reiki history.
I know.
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask you one final question about that I had intended to ask earlier, but what you just said, I think it's a perfect place to ask this question. How do you envision the role of Reiki and crystals too in today's world and going forward as we move into the new consciousness? Do you have any thoughts on that?
What a brilliant question. So I'm in two minds about answering this, because I really see us kind of approaching things from that more kind of clinical, scientific side, and that's always going to run parallel to the spiritual. And as many of us try to make inroads between the two, there's still going to be different avenues for exploring everything. So on the one hand, when it comes to Reiki, I see unprecedented growth in Reiki among conventional healthcare settings. I've worked with a number of people who are kind of spearheading some brilliant movements, excellent trainings. I know that there is a positive and a negative side to moving into that sphere, because it could involve all kinds of regulation and certification that at best will be optional, and at worst could really crack down on Reiki practice. So the way through that is through the spiritual side of things. And if we approach Reiki as a spiritual practice, first and foremost, that engages a different set of criteria for regulation, but it also reminds us that if we're all one in Reiki, then we're all in this together, and the things that affect one part of the Reiki community affect us all. So I anticipate the response to the clinical changes will be the Reiki community doing its best to come together. We're still a collection of human beings, we're a collection of individuals. There's always going to be a little bit of friction and misunderstanding. There's always going to be differences. And I think that's what makes Reiki so beautiful. We have such a diverse array of traditions that have popped up, in many cases, only in the last 30 or 40 years, but certainly it's tracing back to just under 100 years now. Can you imagine how exciting it's going to be to watch the next century as we come together and really forge a firm foundation for where Reiki's going to take us? And as far as crystals go, I'm really hoping that we'll get maybe at one point some peer-reviewed studies, or even if they're just tiny little one-off experiments that demonstrate how effective crystals can be for healing, that would be really exciting for me. There are small experiments that have been done, most of them not peer-reviewed. There is only a couple that I know of that had a really strong kind of medical background to them, and I'd love to see more happening there. But then on the other side, I'd love to see people responding to the need for Mother Earth to be treated more equitably, for the miners who do the work, who do the hard labor of not just digging things out of the earth, but polishing, faceting, and bringing them to the world at large. I'd love to see this shift where we respect the people doing that labor. It is hard work, it is dangerous work, and it would be beautiful if the crystal community starts to make more informed decisions about ethically sourcing their crystals and respecting them, not just as an inert tool, this garnet is going to do this thing for me, but as co-creators, as equal players in the game. All of human existence on Earth is a blink of an eye to a stone. Mm-hmm. And when we kind of remember that, we go, maybe I'm not the one to give orders here. Maybe it's time to just listen. And that's going to be a big change, I think. When more and more people are willing to listen and to give themselves over to that mystery.
I think that is a beautiful message.
That was lovely, and I could not have said it better myself.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You've offered such a wise perspective, Nicholas, with that response to that very deep question of Kathleen's. And I think the message there goes far beyond Reiki and crystals. I think it's about, you know, unity and coming together all the way around the world and across the board in so many different areas. I think listening, as you mentioned, is instrumental in the evolution and ascension of our consciousness and our ways of being. And you put it just absolutely beautifully. And I want to thank you for being with us today, Nicholas. Our time is just about winding down here. And I'd like to invite you to tell our listeners how they might engage with you. Do you have some information for them on how they might contact you, ask you questions?
Absolutely. I do my best to maintain a strong presence through social media. I'd say Instagram and Facebook are the places I'm most active these days. You can find me as The Luminous Pearl in both instances. It's facebook.com/TheLuminousPearl or at TheLuminousPearl on Instagram. Very recently, I think you can find me there also as The Luminous Pearl. It's fascinating to see all the different iterations of people coming to the worlds of crystals and Reiki and spirituality at large through those different media. I do have a website as well. I'll have that link in the show notes for you. You can reach out that way. Any way you want to get in touch with me, please feel free. I really welcome engagement from listeners and readers. So I look forward to connecting with your audience. And thank you so much to both of you for having me on here.
Well, we've just really been honored, Nicholas, and you've just been so gracious with your time. And a sincere thank you from myself and Kathleen. Thank you again for joining us. We are just thrilled to be able to have these conversations with you. If you have ideas or suggestions for future episodes, we invite you to contact us at beyondthereikigateway.com. And we look forward to bringing you future episodes. Thank you again for joining us. And we would invite you to return to another episode as we journey beyond the Reiki Gateway with Kathleen Johnson and Andrea Kennedy.